Namaste. Good to see you all. This evening we start chapter 19 in Essays on the Gita. The title of the chapter is Equality. It appeared in the journal Arya on the 15th of February in 1918. The first piece in the issue was in The Life Divine, of course, The Origin of the Ignorance. Then, The Synthesis of Yoga, Hatha Yoga. Then finally came this chapter on equality, which has great significance in Sri Aurobindo's practice of yoga in establishing one of the centerpieces of his Purna Advaita perspective, something that was achieved in himself in the earliest innings of his practice in yoga, 1908, this first realization. And later, when realization was added to realization, still that equality remained visible, tangible in him up until he left his body. So, samatha, as we often style it, or samatva in Sanskrit, is what we'll be speaking about over the next couple of weeks in this chapter. And you'll remember that there were a number of key elements, key inner signs of what it means to be liberated that he discussed in the last chapter. Well, he's going to recap that in the first several paragraphs here and then continue his argument. Now, how he's been progressing chapter by chapter has been measurable. But here in this chapter on equality, he will move around a good bit. There'll be citations from one chapter of the Gita, then another, etc. And a couple of times he intones a Sanskrit phrase which doesn't actually appear in the Gita, but we can see its relevance to the Gita. So we'll start now, equality. Since knowledge, desirelessness, impersonality, equality, the inner self-existent peace and bliss, freedom from, or at least superiority to, the tangled interlocking of the three modes of nature are the signs of the liberated soul. They must accompany it in all its activities. So the presumption here is that one practices yoga, gains liberation, knows the truth, and yet continues to act in the world. There's no severance of the soul from the doings of the world spirit. One remains engaged in life. They are the condition of that unalterable calm which this soul preserves in all the movement, all the shock, all the clash of forces which surround it in the world. That calm reflects the equable immutability of the Brahman in the midst of all mutations. And it belongs to the indivisible and impartial oneness which is forever immanent in all the multiplicities of the universe. This is an important thing. The spirit is one and constant. Brahman is indivisible and eternal. But nature permits all manner of what appear to the mind to be inequalities, different measurings out of the infinite. And those measurings out are confusing to the mental view and then seem to be Maya. For an equal and all equalizing spirit is that oneness in the midst of the million differences and inequalities of the world. And equality of the spirit is the sole real equality. For in all else in existence, there can only be similarity, adjustment, and balance. But even in the greatest similarities of the world, we find difference of inequality and difference of unlikeness, and the adjusted balancings of the world can only come about by a poising of combined unequal weights. So essentially the backdrop in this, of course, is the Sankhya philosophy of the Purusha watching the activities of Prakriti, of the soul watching the deliberations and the goings hence and the comings back of nature. Hence, the immense importance attached by the Gita in its elements of Karma Yoga to equality. It is the notice of the free spirit's free relations with the world. Self-knowledge, desirelessness, impersonality, bliss, freedom from the modes of nature, when withdrawn into themselves, self-absorbed, inactive, have no need of equality. For they take no cognizance of these things in which the opposition of equality and inequality arises. But the moment the spirit takes cognizance of and deals with the multiplicities, personalities, differences, inequalities of the action of nature, it has to effectuate these other signs of its free status by this one manifesting sign of equality. Knowledge is the consciousness of unity with the One. And in relation with the many different beings and existences of the universe, it must show itself by an equal oneness with all. If we could pause here, this takes us back to chapter 6 in the Gita, shlokas 29 and 31. And it won't take but a moment to read those, as Sri Aurobindo rendered them in English. The man whose self is in yoga sees the self in all beings and all beings in the self. He is equal visioned everywhere. He who sees me everywhere and sees all in me, to him I do not get lost, nor does he get lost to me. The yogin who has taken his stand upon oneness and loves me and all beings, however and in all ways, he lives and acts in me. So this is that knowledge, one in consciousness, in being with the Supreme, and one therefore with all that streams out from the Supreme, and that is everyone and everything. So first, knowledge. Then, impersonality is the one immutable spirit's superiority to the variations of its multiple personality in the world. In its dealings with the personalities of the universe, it must show itself in the equal and impartial spirit of its action with regard to all, however various that action may be made by the variety of relations into which it is molded, or of the conditions under which it has to take place. So, Krishna in the Gita says that none is dear to him, none hated, to all he is equal in spirit. That's 9:29. Yet is the God-lover the special receiver of his grace, because the relation he has created is different, and the one impartial Lord of all yet meets each soul according to its way of approach to him. Desirelessness, and this is 4:11, is the illimitable spirit's superiority to the limiting attraction of the separate objects of desire in the world. When it has to enter into relations with those objects, it must show it, either by an equal and impartial indifference in their possession, or by an equal and impartial, unattached delight in all, and love for all, which, because it is self-existent, does not depend upon possession or non-possession, but is in its essence unperturbed and immutable. For the spirit's bliss is in itself, and if this bliss is to enter into relations with things and creatures, it is only in this way that it can manifest its free spirituality. This is 317, Atmaratihi. Triguna Titya, transcendence of the gunas, is the unperturbed spirit's superiority to that flux of action of the modes of nature which is in its constant character perturbed and unequal. If it has to enter into relations with the conflicting and unequal activities of nature, if the free soul is to allow its nature any action at all, it must show its superiority by an impartial equality towards all activities, results, or happenings. Equality is the sign, and also, for the aspirant, the test. So one can see, regardless of what is happening to the outward personality and the physical body, one can see if inwardly one is moved or not, if the soul has been shaken, or what we take to be the soul has been shaken by the events. Well, it is a guide, because it says we do not perceive. Where there is inequality in the soul, there is in evidence some unequal play of the modes of nature, motion of desire, play of personal will, feeling and action, activity of joy and grief, or that disturbed and disturbing delight, which is not true spiritual bliss, but a mental satisfaction bringing in its train inevitably a counterpart or recoil of mental dissatisfaction. So equality is the sign. That's 248. And then this sentence that we just read is 632. Where there is inequality of soul, there is deviation from knowledge, loss of steadfast abiding in the all-embracing and all-reconciling oneness of the Brahman and unity of things. By his equality, the Karma Yogin knows in the midst of his action that he is free. So this would mean that the, quote, soul referred to here, which feels inequality, is not the actual soul, but is something of the prakritic construction of the nature, getting perhaps close to where the soul resides, but not itself that. Because when you discover the soul, when you discover the one and only spirit in things, yes, that is equality itself. That is samatha. By his equality, the Karma Yogin knows in the midst of his action that he is free. And you can look for that in the Gita and in chapter 12, shlokas 3 and 4, and again 13 and 14. It is the spiritual nature of the equality enjoined, high and universal in its character and comprehension, which gives its distinctive note to the teaching of the Gita in this matter. For otherwise, the mere teaching of equality in itself, as the most desirable status of the mind, feelings, and temperament in which we rise superior to human weakness, is by no means peculiar to the Gita. Equality has always been held up to admiration as the philosophic ideal and the characteristic temperament of the sages. The Gita takes up indeed this philosophic ideal, but carries it far beyond into a higher region where we find ourselves breathing a larger and purer air. Now you remember Sri Aurobindo is steeped in Greek literature. So if ever he read philosophy, it would have been the Greeks. He would have been Plato and Stoicism, etc. Aristotle a bit, and then put it down, put it away. So here we go. The Stoic poise, the philosophic poise of the soul, are only its first and second steps of ascension out of the whirl of the passions and the tossings of desire to a serenity and bliss, not of the gods, but of the divine himself and his supreme self-mastery. So a strength of equality, the capacity to endure, and then the wise forbearance, the vision from above that suggests that you not engage in this and don't engage in that. The Stoic equality, making character its pivot, founds itself upon self-mastery by austere endurance. The happier and serener philosophic equality prefers self-mastery by knowledge, by detachment, by a high intellectual indifference seated above the circumstances to which our nature is prone. Udasinavad asinaha, as the Gita expresses it. That's 9.9. There is also the religious or Christian equality, which is a perpetual kneeling or a prostrate resignation and submission to the will of God. These are the three steps and means towards divine peace. Heroic endurance, sage indifference, pious resignation. Titiksha, 2.14. Udasinata, 6.9. Namas Urnati, 9.34. And by the way, all three of these are themes that figure prominently in Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga. The Gita takes them all in its large synthetic manner and weaves them into its upward soul movement, but it gives to each a profounder root, a larger outlook, a more universal and transcendent significance. For to each, it gives the values of the spirit, its power of spiritual being beyond the strain of character, beyond the difficult poise of the understanding, beyond the stress of the emotions. In other words, it carries it to its spiritual home. The ordinary human soul takes a pleasure in the customary disturbances of its nature life. It is because it has this pleasure, and because having it, it gives a sanction to the troubled play of the lower nature, that the play continues perpetually. Ah, we have implicitly endorsed the play at some deep level. Let's find out what the mystery of that is. For the Prakriti does nothing except for the pleasure and with the sanction of its lover and enjoyer, the Purusha. 13.22, Anumanta, Bhokta, Bharta. We do not recognize this truth because under the actual stroke of the adverse disturbance, smitten by grief, pain, discomfort, misfortune, failure, defeat, blame, dishonor, the mind shrinks back from the blow, while it leaps eagerly to the embrace of the opposite and pleasurable disturbances, joy, pleasure, satisfactions of all kinds, prosperity, success, victory, glory, praise. But this does not alter the truth of the soul's pleasure in life, which remains constant behind the dualities of the mind. This is one of the principal lessons and insights in the life divine. The warrior does not feel physical pleasure in his wounds or find mental satisfaction in his defeats, but he has a complete delight in the Godhead of battle, which brings to him defeat and wounds as well as the joy of victory, and he accepts the chances of the former and the hope of the latter as part of the mingled weft of war, the thing which the delight in him pursues. Even wounds bring him a joy and pride in memory, complete when the pain of them has passed, but often enough present even while it is there and actually fed by the pain. Defeat keeps for him the joy and pride of indomitable resistance to a superior adversary, or if he is of a baser kind, the passions of hatred and revenge, which also have their darker and crueler pleasures. So it is with the pleasure of the soul in the normal play of our life. You can see the daivic, the godlike, and the asuric, the dark and demonic tendencies that are present in nature. Each speak in some way to the equability of the soul, which accepts it all, feels it all, and finds rasa, an essential delight behind each experience. Why else would you want to remain in nature in the midst of this suffering and the vanity of these so-called pleasures? No, all of these are mere waves of a deeper delight. And when you find the Purusha, you are rooted in that which conjoins Purusha and Prakriti, which marries them. Spirit and matter are married together again in the integrity of that spiritual experience, the oneness of Atman, Atmarattihi, Brahman, Brahmastiti. The mind recoils by pain and dislike from the adverse strokes of life. That is nature's device for enforcing a principle of self-protection, jugupsa, so that the vulnerable, nervous, and bodily parts of us may not unduly rush upon self-destruction to embrace it. It takes joy in the favorable touches of life. That is nature's lure of rajasic pleasure, so that the force in the creature may overcome the tamasic tendencies of inertia and inactivity and be impelled fully towards action, desire, struggle, success. And by its attachment to these things, her ends may be worked out. So pleasure and pain lure and goad us forward. Nature has a way of driving us upwards. There is implicit in Prakriti a path upwards. It is implied in the Sankhyan philosophy, which the Gita uses as a basic vocabulary, that nature is always trying to bring the soul to deliverance. If it seems to be enmeshed in what is material and inconscient, really it is being driven home always, because the tree of nature leads back. It leads from the gross externalities back to buddhi, back towards enlightenment, back towards the oneness of the self. You can't get lost in nature. Sir, it will deliver you. Madam, you are on the way. En route, as they say. Our secret soul takes a pleasure in this strife and effort, and even a pleasure in adversity and suffering, which can be complete enough in memory and retrospect, but is present too behind at the time, and often even rises to the surface of the afflicted mind to support it in its passion. But what really attracts the soul is the whole mingled weft of the thing we call life. With all its disturbance of struggle and seeking, its attractions and repulsions, its offer and its menace, its varieties of every kind. To the rajasic desire soul in us, a monotonous pleasure, success without struggle, joy without a shadow, must, after a time, become fatiguing, insipid, cloying. It needs a background of darkness to give full value to its enjoyment of light. For the happiness it seeks and enjoys is of that very nature. It is in its very essence relative and dependent on the perception and experience of its opposite. The joy of the soul in the dualities is the secret of the mind's pleasure in living. This would take us back again to chapter 6, shlokas 28 through 30, and we can read it again. We'll include 31. Thus freed from stain of passion and putting himself constantly into yoga, the yogin easily and happily enjoys the touch of Brahman, which is an exceeding bliss. The man whose self is in yoga sees the self in all beings and all beings in the self. He is equal visioned everywhere. He who sees me everywhere and sees all in me, to him I do not get lost, nor does he get lost to me. The yogin who has taken his stand upon oneness and loves me in all beings, however and in all ways he lives and acts in me. So, I think we can put a bookmark there. This is not a terribly long chapter, but we'll take our time going through it, probably in three segments this time. So we're talking about light and dark. And today, of course, in India, it is Diwali, Deepavali, the row of lights, the festival of light. And there are a number of mythologies which speak to this in the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata. But the one which we tend to come to, especially since we're dealing with Krishna and the Gita, is the one which is in the Mahabharata. And it tells the tale of Narakasura, and how this asura goes and captures through force, through cunning, through compulsion, all the powers of the earth now and the heavens. And these are represented as goddesses, as daughters, as wives. He takes to his fortress in hell 16,000 virgins. In other words, these are unexploited powers which will not be used for the development of weal in the world. And the gods and goddesses are unhappy that this has occurred. Twashtra, Aditi, especially insulted, come to find Krishna at Dwaraka and ask him if he will go and confront this great asura and restore order. And Krishna very happily says yes. And he crosses all manner of difficulties. great rivers with violent waters and terrible fields of brambles, and finds his way down to the very gate of hell and goes plunging inside, where he faces demon after demon, rakshasas and asuras, and finally he faces Narakasura himself and challenges them, "Give them to me." Naraka says, "No, take them from me. I will fight you." And Krishna says, "So be it." And Naraka hurls one of his fabulous weapons, and it goes piercing through the air. And as it approaches Krishna, Krishna simply opens his arms wide and allows this terrible missile to strike his chest, and it falls at his feet, transformed into a flower. And Krishna smiles, and Naraka, astonished but infuriated, reaches for his next astra weapon. But before he can throw it, Krishna has thrown his chakra, his spinning disc, and shoo, it has beheaded Naraka. And then there is freedom. Suddenly, in that pit of hell, there is light. And there stands Krishna. And he takes the 16,000 virgins back with him into the air of the world, into the light of the sky, and back to their celestial abodes. And they all say, "Krishna, Krishna, marry me, marry me." And he indeed marries all 16,000. And this, you have to understand the power of the myth. This is the marriage of spirit and nature. This is the rejoining of all of this together. This is the integration which makes divine life possible. So harmony is restored, and the victory of light over darkness is secured. So Krishna has not renounced life, but fulfilled and restored it to its proper place. So this is one of the myths, at least, behind the whole process which we call Deepavali. So somewhere in your heart and in your mind, if you don't have the space in your home to light candles or lights as they would do in India, at least let an array of light beckon to you from inside your own consciousness and remind you that you are on the way. Ever and ever again, we shall say, we have to do it here and now. We can postpone no longer. If there is a solution, we are the solution. I think I'm forgetting to say something. Well. I won't forget to read Savitri. Book four, the Book of Birth and Quest, and Canto four, the Quest. And Savitri is astir in the world, looking for the one who carries truth, and she will shortly find him. There, another marriage. I think I intend to start on page 383. A little bit down the page. You'll forgive me if I change my mind and begin on page 382. Ah, our dear Vasanti Rao has joined. Quick capture of the photograph. The seers attuned to the universal will, content in him who smiles behind earth's forms, abode ungrieved by the insistent days. About them, like green trees girdling a hill, young grave disciples, fashioned by their touch, trained to the simple act and conscious word, greatened within and grew to meet their heights. Far wandering seekers on the eternal's path, brought to these quiet founts their spirit's thirst, and spent the treasure of a silent hour, bathed in the purity of the mild gaze, that uninsistent ruled them from its peace, and by its influence found the ways of calm. The infants of the monarchy of the worlds, the heroic leaders of a coming time, king children nurtured in that spacious air, like lions gamboling in sky and sun, received half consciously their godlike stamp. Formed in the type of the high thoughts they sang, they learned the wide magnificence of mood that makes us comrades of the cosmic urge, no longer chained to their small separate selves, plastic and firm beneath the eternal hand, met nature with a bold and friendly clasp, and served in her the power that shapes her works. One-souled to all, and free from narrowing bonds, large like a continent of warm sunshine, in wide equality's impartial joy, these sages breathed for God's delight in things, assisting the slow entries of the gods, sowing in young minds immortal thoughts they lived, taught the great truth to which man's race must rise, or open the gates of freedom to a few. Imparting to our struggling world the light, they breed like spirits from time's dull yoke released, comrades and vessels of the cosmic force, using a natural mastery like the sun's, their speech, their silence was a help to earth. A magic happiness flowed from their touch. Oneness was sovereign in that sylvan peace. The wild beast joined in friendship with its prey, persuading the hatred and the strife to cease. The love that flows from the one mother's breast healed with their hearts the hard and wounded world. Others escaped from the confines of thought to where mind motionless sleeps, waiting light's birth, and came back quivering with a nameless force, drunk with a wine of lightning in their cells. Intuitive knowledge leaping into speech, seized, vibrant, kindling with the inspired word, hearing the subtle voice that clothes the heavens, carrying the splendor that has lit the suns, they sang infinity's names and deathless powers in meters that reflect the moving worlds, sight's sound waves breaking from the soul's great deep. You'll remember. remember that Sri Aurobindo confessed that that last line, sights, sound waves breaking from the soul's great deeps, comes from an overmental consciousness, with a touch from something above. So, much love to you all. Namaste. Good to see you. Good to be with you in whatever way we're together. It's felt, is it not? I look forward to seeing you again. Much love. Namaste. All the very best to you. Jai Ma. Thank you.